This is Orson Welles, come to call again for a talk about people and the things they're doing all over the world. Then there's the story I promised for this week. We'll get to the story in just a minute.
First, just a word about Lear Incorporated. Lear, that's L-E-A-R, makers of Lear radios and sponsors of this program. It may be news to you that Lear has been making radios since 1930. More likely than not, you haven't heard the name Lear until recently. That's because the radios that Lear has been building for 15 years have been very special radios. Radios that were made for a very exacting purpose. They are aircraft radios, the kind of instruments that men stake the safety of their planes and their passengers upon. Today, Lear radios are in use in the air lanes all the way from Alaska to South America. This is why we say, since 1930, Lear has been the name men fly by. Now, for the first time, Lear is making home radios as well as aircraft radios. And when this kind of craftsmanship and forward thinking go into home radios, they become instruments of unusual excellence. We'll tell you more about these sets a little later. Now, Mr. Welles brings you his views and opinions on events as he sees them. The opinions are his own and do not necessarily represent the views of Lear Incorporated.
Ladies and gentlemen, my views are not necessarily represented by the sign I told you about in the ABC parking lot. You remember I mentioned that sign last week. It says, "No bailment created here." And rashly offered free radio tickets to anyone who could decode the phrase for me. Well, I spent most of this last week paying off. Your obedient servant has never had so much mail before in his life. I'm forced to one of two conclusions. That the only people who don't know what to create bailment means are me and the man who runs the parking lot. Or that every living member of the Bar Association listens to this show. A solemn thought. To protect myself from distractions like that sign, I've moved this microphone all the way out to our house in Brentwood, California. And although this is still the American Broadcasting Company, I'd like you to know about the new branch studio they've opened in our living room. It'll help explain any unrehearsed sound effects we may feature from time to time, such as the merry jingle of a Cocker Spaniel's license tag, which punctuated some of our more earnest moments on the last broadcast, or the lusty wail of an 8-month-old daughter, a sound I'm expecting any time now from the nursery above. Well, I notice in the paper there's some talk about a new naval uniform. Seems like a good idea to me. Never could understand why they made sailors' pants so wide at the bottom when they need the material so desperately up above. Eddie Cantor, as you may have heard, added somebody new to his radio show last week, Thelma Carpenter. She's a singer, and in the continuity, she's brought in as a friend of the family, not as a servant. On the air, that's a fine, fresh way of treating a Negro artist. Last night, I heard somebody ask Eddie why, in his introduction, he made no mention of the fact that Miss Carpenter's colored. I liked Eddie's answer. In my life, he said, I've introduced a lot of singers, but I've never described one of them as a white singer. It reminded me of a story about General Eisenhower. In London, before D-Day and Ike's staff, there was a British officer who was pretty stupid and pompous and got on everybody's nerves more than some. An American colonel came to Eisenhower one day with a beef about him. I just can't get anything done, he complained, with that ignorant British blankety-blank so-and-so. I think I know the man you mean, said the Supreme Commander of the Allied Forces in Europe. He's certainly the most trying and inefficient officer I've ever had to work with. He is, as you say, ignorant. You have my permission to call him a blankety-blank anytime you want to, because it's true, but you cannot call him a British blankety-blank in my presence. You may describe him as a so-and-so, but I will not tolerate your calling him a British so-and-so. Eisenhower got rid of the so-and-so, and the colonel who called him a British so-and-so was relieved of his duty and went back to the States. Speaking of Eisenhower, we saw his motion picture the other night. We have time. I'd like to tell you about it. First, a word or two about the news. We don't know yet what Ike had to say to Patton, who wants to give Bavaria back to the Nazis, apparently. We'll probably never hear the exact words, which is a shame. Old Blood and Guts has put his foot in it before. This time, my guess is he's in it way over his shiny boots, above the pearl handle shooting irons and right up to the well-known lacquered helmet. But the truth is, old B&G isn't the only champion of a soft peace for Germany. Many of the things we're up to in Germany and in Japan are a source of worried suspicion to our recent allies. Jimmy Burns has made the Russians particularly unhappy these last 3 weeks. And Truman's denials, notwithstanding, the London Conference of Foreign Ministers is a washout, a hopeless flop. Here at home, men close to the scene are saying that the president's political honeymoon is over. Many top-flight operators who worked their hearts out for Roosevelt at low salaries are now heeding the siren song of better pay or leaving government for business. According to them, Harry Truman's Little Man Act is wearing thin to the people who are thrown out of work and can't get unemployment insurance. president won't be able to keep many valuable young men in government service unless he persuades them soon that he's really fighting for the program on which he and Roosevelt were elected. They don't mind a losing battle, but they do want the chance to get at least one belt in before the gong rings. And in England, in the new Labour government, the same kind of young men are grumbling about McDonaldism. Younger Labour members in the House of Commons are insisting out loud that their administration apply the basic policy on which it was elected. For Britain's Foreign Office, the two great problems today, of course, are one, India, where promised radical changes in administration have yet to be made, and two, Palestine, where, past all argument, the doors must be opened much more widely for the Jews of Europe. Domestically, of course, Britain's first problem is the need for food. Friends of mine just off the plane from England say that the British people have getting less to eat now, if possible, than during the Blitz. Of course, on the continent, things are immeasurably worse. Well, it seems the woman from Weehawken still thinks I'm a loony who wants to give America away to the foreigners. In her latest letter, she accuses me of wanting to feed the world. Madam, I wish I could. The world is very hungry, and hungry is a bad word. And hunger is not a symptom of peace. Madam, your government and mine promised food for starving Europe. We're not keeping our promise. With other nations, we pledged our share of food to UNRWA. But unlike other nations, we aren't honoring that pledge. What other nations, you ask? Well, Canada, for instance. Canada has just started meat rationing again to try to help stop the spread of famine abroad. Who's to blame? No individual, no group, no agency is willing to admit particular responsibility. Really, it's all of us who failed, who've fallen down. You know, we promised 4,921 tons of dried eggs. We've not yet delivered a single egg, not even a rotten one. We pledged 3,943 tons of margarine and 34,446 tons of sugar. We failed on those pledges. If it's our fault, madam, yours and mine, what can we do about it? Well, we can wire the White House, the Secretary of Agriculture, and our congressmen. Our congressmen aren't even talking about the matter nowadays. Seems there aren't any votes in Europe. All in all, I think you and I are being pretty poorly represented these days by the politicians we elected to Congress. The Senate, you know, is stripping the Wagner-Murray full employment bill of its meaning and all possible effectiveness. Taft claims there's no panacea to unemployment. Perhaps some of our senators are willing to see a few millions waiting in line at the soup kitchens. But the men who found jobs in wartime, and above all the men who fought in the war, won't be content to consider unemployment one of the blessings of peace. Last week, I started a story dedicated to all those who've been objecting to our references to bullfighting and who sympathize with the bull. A fighting bull is the hero of this story, and it's a true story. His name was Bonito. He grew up in a place where fighting bulls are raised, with a little boy, the son of one of the ranch hands. They spent most of their time together, these two. They were as close friends as a boy and his dog ever are. Now, if I were to tell you that my daughter was playing in the jungle with a lion or a king cobra, it would be no less remarkable than this, because no living thing is more innately vicious, more terribly dangerous, more untamable than the fighting bull. And Bonito was no weakling to all appearances. He was the superior of any of the animals bred up to that time on that famous ranch. Yet, he was like a puppy with a little boy. And as he grew, as wise and gentle as a good old horse, retired to the pastures. Well, imagine the consternation when the two were discovered together one day. The beast feeding out of the child's hand. It was believed by all that despite his handsome looks, Bonito would prove a coward. When his time came to be sent to the city for the corrida, the owner doubted little that here was an animal appointed to disgrace a proud breed. The little boy ran off in the night and followed to the place where his beloved pet must meet his death. A sad time for the little boy, you can be sure. Before the tragedy, he went to pray for the creature to whom he had given all his childish love. And there, in the chapel, kneeling at the altar beside him, the little boy saw the great matador who was to kill Bonito or be killed by him. They prayed side by side, the boy for the bull's life, the torero for his own, then left by separate doors, the bullfighter to prepare for the paseo to brief his quadrilla, to wait in the shadows under the arena, sweating with fear as matadors always do. Even on the coolest afternoon, the little boy to spend a last tearful moment with his friend, the big, black, wise-looking beast, waiting for death in the wooden cage. Music and the great roar of the crowd. Doors suddenly open before the bull. The hornet sting of the ranch collar spiked into the great hump of muscle on his back. A fine entrance. Here was a great bull, and the crowd knew it. The critics leaned forward in their seats. Now, our great Faena is preserved for the students of the art in careful records. And to this day, we know exactly how the great bull and the great matador worked together in the blazing plaza on that historic afternoon. Every move of the cape, how Bonito charged and charged again, straight as a locomotive, noble as a hero out of Homer. But of all this, the little boy saw nothing. He could not watch. If he had tried, he would have seen nothing for the tears. Then came time for the kill. The moment of truth, the Spaniards call it. The sword was raised. Silence choked the plaza. Then, at the very last instant, the stillness was shattered by the cry of a trumpet. The executioner lowered his sword, smiling. Hand flushed with such triumph as comes in a lifetime, to few men left the arena. His adversary, still furiously alive, stood his ground under the cruel sun. Then spoke the highest authority of the corrida, addressing himself in formal tones to the victorious bull. Bonito, you are more than brave. We have seen you reaffirm the dignity and splendor of the art and of the breed. We therefore pardon you. Go back to the place of your birth and beget more of your kind. And so it happened, as sometimes happens, but very rarely, that for extreme bravery, a bull was spared his life. But Bonito, still blind with rage, understood no word of this, and feeling no gratitude, refused to leave the ring. They sent the cows in after him, but he turned on them, and they, poor creatures, stampeded, panicked. He had won this ground in battle, and he would not budge. Then a great gasp, a shudder of fear and outrage went up in the plaza. Somehow, a little boy had jumped into the center of the ring. Men turned their eyes away from the expected horror, but when they looked again, wonder of wonders, there was the little boy standing, cool and safe, beside Bonito, this phenomenon of fury, this terror among fighting bulls. And what was the child doing? Patting the head between the frightful horns. And if they'd known it, whispering words of comfort to an old friend. Amazed, they saw the great Bonito nuzzle this child like a colt, then move politely after him, like a little dog, out of the ring. And so the two went back to their ranch together, and Bonito, according to the terms of his pardon, had many brave sons. And in the fullness of time, so did his little friend. Since this story is perfectly true, I'm very glad to tell you that they both lived happily ever after. Before I leave, I'd like you to hear about an awfully good picture we saw last night. But first, your attention, please, for an interesting announcement.
Now, just a word about Lear home radios. You probably know why I emphasize the word home. It's because the name Lear has been known mostly for its very fine aircraft radios. Now, the kind of skill and craftsmanship that make Lear aircraft radios so outstanding is going into radios that you can buy for your home. Some models include television. Some have the wonderful Lear wire recorder. And there are record players with automatic record changers, a new static-free FM, and world-scanning shortwave. With so much quality and advanced engineering knowledge built into these radios, you might expect they'd cost a lot. But that just isn't so with Lear radios. They're right along in price with radios far less distinguished. There's a table model at $19.95. And at the other end of the line, there's a beautiful console with the best of everything at $500. The more you appreciate fine reproduction, the more you'll recognize their fine performance and agree that Lear gives you the most for every dollar you spend. Remember the name Lear, L-E-A-R. And now a few words about next week.
Like you, we thought we had our fill of war commentaries, but The True Glory by Carol Reed and Garson Kanin is by so much the best that we abandoned all resistance to more battle footage and gave in to a really great experience. The True Glory. It's the Eisenhower picture. Please don't miss it. Well, now the clock tells me I must say goodbye. Please let me come to call again. And thanks for this time. Until then, speaking for my sponsors, the makers of Lear radios, and my daughter upstairs, who's been nice enough not to spoil her daddy's broadcast, I remain, as always, obediently yours.
This is the American Broadcasting Company.